Can't watch the road as I was driving. But that was my first vehicle, and we started hauling our lawnmowers in the back of that, and we were able to mow more lawns because of that. And from there, we would start hauling yard waste and even some things to the dump. And we found out, man, there's more money in that than there is in mowing lawns. excuse me. So I made a little rip-off tag number thing and put it in the local grocery store for people who needed hauling services. And so we were starting to get calls from that. And we were staying busy with that. And then my brother was involved. He's a few years younger than I am.
One of the most important things I've learned in my life is that a person can achieve all their goals, they can be wealthy, and still not be fully free. As I climbed the wealth ladder and grew a company that was one of the most successful real estate investment companies of its kind here in St. Louis, Missouri, on the outside, I had everything I had dreamed of. The beautiful wife, nicer car than I thought I'd drive, nicer home, beautiful kids. And yet, on the inside, I didn't really feel any different. I still felt, quite frankly, like a slave. I was chasing money. I was chasing my next goal. And when I hit the goal, I wouldn't take the time to celebrate it. And I didn't know how to fully enjoy the journey along the way. So as I've aged, I've gotten curious, you know, how do we make our entire lives wealthy and not just one component of it? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to interview the guests on this show. And yeah, we're going to talk about what they've done and what their stories are and how they've become financially wealthy. But also, I want to dig into their relationship with money and their relationships with other and if they have more joy and fulfillment than when they started out, or if they don't, and why or why not. So thanks for tuning in. We got a great guest coming for you. Let's get started. Well, welcome, Brig. How are you today? What's going on in your world, man?
Hey, Jim. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me. I am on the West Coast in Southern California right now, and for my granddaughter's birthday. So you caught me out here, but it's going great. I'm just happy to be here.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I'm excited to get going on your story. And for those of you that haven't read it, Brig wrote a book called Moving Forward, A Stickman's Journey for Hope and Meaning. And it's by Brig, and he's the original Stickman and founding member of Two Men in a Truck, for those of you that don't know. So, oh man, we got a journey to talk about today.
Yeah.
So let's go back before Two Men in a Truck, and or what's the... Just a quick origin story, I guess, of Two Men in a Truck. Let's get started on that.
Well, Jim, we were always hardworking kids. So, there was myself, my brother and sister, and we were always looking for ways of making a dollar, even when we were young. And one of mine was mowing lawns. And even before we had driver's licenses, a couple of buddies and myself, we would pull our lawnmowers behind our bikes and we would mow lawns. And as time went on, I acquired a 1966 Ford pickup truck for $200. It was a truck that was bought from Michigan State University. It was an old ag truck. And many of your listeners have probably driven an old three on the tree, transmission. And that's what it was. And all the can't watch the road as I was driving. But that was my first vehicle, and we started hauling our lawnmowers in the back of that, and we were able to mow more lawns because of that. And from there, we would start hauling yard waste and even some things to the dump. And we found out, man, there's more money in that than there is in mowing lawns. excuse me. So I made a little rip-off tag number thing and put it in the local grocery store for people who needed hauling services. And so we were starting to get calls from that, and we were staying busy with that. And then my brother was involved. He's a few years younger than I am. And we went from that 66 Ford pickup truck to it's an old step van, probably a 12-foot step van. And from there, we started doing used furniture, deliveries, apartments, homes. We called ourselves, my brother named it Men at Work Movers. And our ad said men at work movers underneath that. It said two men in a truck. And it would say men at work movers, two men in a truck, $25 an hour. Now you have to understand that's like, you know, over 40 years ago. So we were we did quite well for young guys making that kind of money with not much overhead. John and I eventually went to college. My mom said the phone is ringing off the hook for us. She asked if she could hire a couple guys. We said, yeah, that'd be great. And so she hired a couple people, a couple guys. It worked out well because when John and I came back from Christmas break or summer vacation, the business was already up and going. My mom said, why don't you call yourselves what you are, drop men at work movers and call yourselves what you are, two men in the truck. So that's where the name came from. We took $3 from every move that we did and we put it into this candy dish sat on our kitchen table. And my mom took a napkin and a Sharpie marker and she drew a cartoon, truck with two stick men in it. So everybody else in the family knew that that money was ours. And that is, the logo, that your listeners are probably seeing on our trucks, today. Yeah. Or if you don't know of two men in a truck, Google it and you'll see it. And that drawing came right from a napkin that my mom drew with a Sharpie. When we came back from school, she had bought a new truck. We thought she was crazy. Cause there went, you know, now we've got overhead, but the business continued to grow. And, it was my mom, Mary Ellen Sheets, that would later, she would franchise the business in 1989. And, all of us kids, my sister, my brother, myself, all had our own two men in a truck franchises. And, that's kind of how it started.
Well, that's amazing. And then, so how old were you then when you kind of officially had your own franchise? Was this after college? You went to college first or?
Yeah, I look at God's timing and all this. It was really good. The business made absolutely no money in the beginning. All those kids were involved in some aspect of it, but we were really forced to go out and do other jobs. My brother started, he graduated, he had a business degree and he also had a, criminal justice. And so he worked a little bit in criminal justice, for GM. My sister, ended up selling pharmaceuticals in Atlanta, Georgia, and I became a Prudential insurance agent up in the UP. And then until the business started taking off, but the cool part was we kind of learned a lot of what we brought to the business from different variations of the job market out there. And so we piled on. I mean, we were all very operational. We knew how they all worked. And we just kind of went from there. But yeah, my mom lived off of, for 2 years, she didn't pay herself and she ate ramen noodles every day for dinner. If you ask her, she'll say it was the craziest, happiest time of my life. I'd say, Mom, I think you're crazy. But, she really enjoyed, the early days of it.
So, how were you just like on the internal front? Like, were you having fun with it? Were you stressed out as you were getting more involved in the startup or, you know, how was,
I looked at it really as an adventure. I mean, we started ours up in Marquette, Michigan. It was the smallest market. It still is the smallest market now. But when you work in a small market, you have to be the jack of all trades, right? I mean, you have to know how to, book jobs over the phone. You have to know how to actually move furniture, you know, give estimates, do payroll. My wife did a lot of the payroll tax thing. And I did all more of the operational stuff with our little one and two in Marquette. So I kind of loved the adventure of it, especially working in something that was so buttoned down like insurance, to get out of there and just to have a hoodie on and jeans and being on the trucks every day and the smell of those moving pads on the truck. I loved it. I loved building it. And once I left the insurance side of it and started working full time, we were running the business a few years while I was selling insurance and it was kind of like kicking off. I wasn't really doing a lot, but once I was able to get on the trucks, motivate the guys. We added another truck and then we really started moving, and it was, I enjoyed most of it. I think time probably, as time goes by, it kind of sands down some of those rough edges that you forget some of the hard things. But for the most part, and when I moved on with my career, and I, you know, we eventually sold that franchise. My sister asked if we could sell and move back downstate and help run the company. A lot of the things that I learned on the operational side, I was able to plug right in to the corporate office, you know, helping with training. And, you know, I was a field consultant. I'd go and travel and work with the existing franchisees. And so it's one thing, you know, that many of your listeners probably know this, but there's never a wasted day at work. You're always learning something that you can use in the future. And so I kind of worked my way up through Two Men in a Truck. I was a head of marketing, not a marketing, but of a franchise sales. From there, I was really the unofficial vice president of my sister, who was the president at the time. And then I became president and CEO down the road. And every one of those jobs, I could build off of the job I had before. And so I was really grounded. My foundation was really strong. And, and that's why I would tell them, when I would travel and talk with the movers, I'd tell them the same thing. You know, I'd ask them, raise your hand if it's your goal in life to be a mover. You know, no hands would go up. And I said, mine either. It wasn't, but I took advantage of the opportunities that were in front of me, and I parlayed those into better opportunities. And so a lot of our franchisees came from that world too. You know, they started out on the trucks or on the phones, and over half of our franchisees at the time came from those places. So there's a lot of diamonds, a lot of gems out there. Don't walk by them. You know, you pick them up, put them in your pocket, and you move on to the next thing.
So what do you think, what can you attribute that, like being able to grow that many leaders? What would you say was like the important, like one of the more important pieces of that? Like how you're able to do that?
That's a great question, Jim. One that I don't get asked enough, I think. God has made us very adventurous, all of us. And we're each uniquely made. And so when you look at your employees as God's creation and uniquely made, understand that he also made them full of adventure as well. I think some of the biggest mistakes I see in leadership is that many leaders are very ego driven, and they will be the ones that make the decisions. They will be the ones that will talk to the media. It's all about them. And it's like, what you want to do is take all of your employees and say, we're all part of this adventure. We have to work hard. And when you have really good employees that have shown their stripes, you know, they're there every day. They're involved. They're engaged. Give them more opportunities to grow and be part of the adventure of your business. And, I think that's one of the main reasons why people leave, organizations, is because they don't feel valued. They don't feel like they're waking up in the morning and making a difference. Now, it doesn't mean that they all work out. You got to make sure that everyone's sitting on the right seat of the bus, right? But once you know that they're there, give them decisions and to follow through on those things. And I did the same thing with our franchisees. I had two handfuls of franchisees I would completely trust with the business. We never had an outside board of directors. And this was a business that was doing over $600 million a year. And people thought, you're insane, dude. Why don't you need an outside board of directors? I said, no, I don't. I've got franchisees that are fully engaged. I've got people at the corporate office that I would die for. We can make decisions fast, turning and burning. When you find the right people in place that are engaged and they feel that need of adventure and excitement, they feel that being fulfilled where they are. They're not going anywhere. And I think that's one of the keys. And where I would see before is there's people that, you know, people chase the almighty dollar in business. And I've seen in cases where people are, you know, they're cutting customers short. They are maybe not paying their vendors on time. They're not paying their, maybe their corporate people the way that they should, because everything's being driven by that bottom line. That is not sustainable. What you want to do is have, the culture where your vendors are your partners. And I'm not saying you don't negotiate with them, but you make sure that they're paid on time. They're another set of eyes on your business. Don't cut them short. Take care of the people that are working for you. Take care of your franchisees, your employees. Take care of the communities that your businesses are in. Make sure that you're giving back. The money, Jim, comes in the back door, not the front door. And so many businesses are trying to get that almighty dollar to come through the front door. It's like, you take care of everybody, make sure everybody's good. Those dollars will chase you. You don't chase them. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I've seen. And this isn't coming from a guy that went to Harvard Business School. Mm-hmm. I graduated from Northern Michigan University with a geography degree. But I learned a lot of these things when I was working on the truck, motivating the mover next to me. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh man, this is how you treat people.
Did you, so you learned that originally. So like, and do you feel like that's was innate to you, or do you feel like you learned this? Like, just
no, I learned it because, where I worked in the past, I saw where people were not valued. I saw where in company meetings where people were belittled. I would see those things even when I was younger, and I'd play a game with myself. How would I change this? How could this have a better ending? What would that look like? And that is what I saw. I saw it especially on the insurance side where people were, being belittled and ridiculed. And I watched people looking for ways to get out. And then I had a boss come in, his name was Jim Moore. He was an ex-state trooper, big jolly guy. He brought more joy into that business that I learned from him. I saw he had a completely different approach to management. My insurance, I was a successful insurance agent. My career there lasted a couple more years than I thought it would because of him. And we would go to meetings and we'd meet prospects together, and he'd have them laughing, relaxed. And then in the end, we were helping them. And that really changed the way that, that I approached, my business with insurance, and to see a whole office environment change within a matter of a month was amazing to me. And, it's funny. He called me a few years ago and I said, "You're the best boss I ever had, Jim." He's like, "Why is that?" And I said, "Because you had fun. We had fun on that job. You know, we helped a lot of people. We sold a lot of insurance. Everybody was happy. It was fun to come into work." And he's like, "Man, I'm glad I called you. You made my day." I wasn't that good of a manager, Greg. And I said, "You were to me. You changed my whole attitude." And it just basically validated the thought, validated already what I thought. And that is, get people involved in the adventure of the business, the excitement of it. And don't beat on those employees that make a mistake. Two mistakes you can make. One of them, if you're sitting back on your heels and you're not aggressively doing your job, that's something we need to have a talk about. The other one is you took a risk, a calculated risk, and it didn't work out and you fell on your face. And it's like, all right, pick yourself up, brush yourself off. What did we learn from this? And let's move forward. But I knew that mistake was made not out of laziness, but it was made out of it's just learning. We all do it. And so really take a look at that. And even when something went wrong, I wouldn't jump on an employee right away. I'd first of all just ask them, we'd go over what happened, and then maybe they don't have the tools they need. How could I help you to not have this happen again? Is it a training thing? Is it something in our processes that aren't right? And you'll save half of those by just having that conversation and finding out, no, it's a good employee. They just didn't have the tools or maybe.
So you were intimately involved with the expansion of it. And like, how many franchisees you had before you took over that role?
Oh, probably. It was, We're probably right around 180, something like that.
Oh, wow. And then when you left the role, I don't ultimately becoming the CEO, how many franchisees was like, were you a part of that?
When we sold, we had 380 locations in the U.S., 29 in Canada, one in the U.K., one in Ireland. Wow. It was amazing because it was when we, you know, at one point we had, 3,400 trucks. And if you were to line those trucks up bumper to bumper, there'd be an unbroken line of over 25 miles long. That's how many trucks we had.
Wow.
And we had 10,000 employees during the summer. And it was just growing gangbusters. And we have sold a business 3 years ago. Boy, time flies. And they're doing well. They're continue to do well. It was a larger company that ServiceMaster that bought us out. And now our CEO of Two Minute Truck is now the CEO of ServiceMaster. And our president of Two Minute Truck is the president of several of ServiceMaster's other franchises. So they tapped into a lot of our executives, and which makes me and my family really proud. Excuse me.
So did you, when it was growing, like, and you had like initial growth, so it was not making any money, and then it started making a lot of money, right? Once you got to, the critical mass, what was, like from an internal, like more of like a spiritual journey standpoint, when you kind of quote unquote got there,
right?
Like let's talk on that. Like what happened to you there?
Yeah, I think I'll back up a little bit just to kind of give your listeners some reference. My wife and I, she's given me the permission to talk about this. I got my wife pregnant when we were in college. Fran told me that you can do what you want, but I'm going to have this baby. I had no faith at the time. She basically allowed me just to walk away from this. And but what had happened, Jim, is I fell in love with her more because I loved her grit. She was number 12 out of 14 kids, living in the west end of the Upper Peninsula, a family that I'm not going to say they were poor, but they were broke. But I loved her grit. She was a great student. And she had some things, some attributes that I wish I had. I pleaded with her to marry me because I said, we're probably going to get married anyway. And so she decided to marry me, and she raised two kids, our baby and myself, until I grew up a little bit. But anyway, we started out, we didn't have anything. We had, I call Alicia, our daughter, who I'm out here visiting right now. She was our welfare baby. I mean, we had to have her with welfare. I couldn't believe that because I was always a worker, but, that was just while we were, and we both graduated, from college at the same time. She was pregnant. We got married. And we just, we paid our student loans. We just, it was something that we did. My first year, I think made $20,000. We didn't have two nickels to rub together, but something I want your listeners to know, I never considered myself poor. I considered myself broke, and I came up with a line that being poor is a state of mind. Being broke is just a point in time. And so I knew that we were grinders, and we continuously worked and worked, and we slowly worked out of that. But that mindset kept us working hard all the way up until, the day I retired, and we're still doing a lot of other things. So to get back to your question, what was going to bring me freedom? What was my goal? My goal is to make money, pure and simple. I mean, it was like, if you had money, especially when you don't have money compared to in your mind, when you have money, I want my freedom and I want the best for my family. And so my goal was to make, and it took a few years to do it. I'd say by the time my sister called and had me asked if I'd move downstate to lower Michigan, to Lansing, Michigan, and help run the business, I really felt that I made it. And for your listeners, that's what, that book is really about that. That's a big chunk of the book is when I finally felt that I made it, we just bought a ranch house in a really nice neighborhood with an in-ground pool. And in my mind, it was like, man, I made it, you know. We had leased an Audi A4. I thought that was a very sophisticated car, you know, and it's just a stamp of approval on my forehead. I thought wealthy guys drank really good scotch. So, you know, it's like I went out and bought a bottle of Johnny Walker Black. I thought about joining a country club where I could rub elbows with other rich guys, you know, and talk about business. I just didn't know what this was going to feel like, you know. And so there was one day that Fran was gone with the kids. I had just cleaned the pool and mowed the lawn and everything just looked pristine. And I just, it's time to have that, you know, a cigar and that Johnny Walker on the rocks in the backyard. And I don't know, Jim, if you drank scotch or not, but I don't know what I was expecting when I took a hit of that, probably out of an old milk glass. I almost puked, man. It was like, this is not what I was expecting. I remember pouring it out on my grass after I finished what was in my mouth thinking, damn, I hope that doesn't kill my grass.
You know? Yeah, scotch will grow some hair on your chest, that's for sure.
It will. So anyway, I finished my cigar and I just thought, you know what, it's going to take a while to really know what this lifestyle is all about. And I'm going to tell you right now, it's like the next day I woke up and I just felt an absolute emptiness. It was like, whoa, what is this? And it perpetuated to the point where I could barely breathe. I mean, this went on for like a month and I went to go see a doctor and he's like, you're in good shape. He said, there's no problems. He said, you know what I do find is I find out that people, guys like you, once they get into their 40s, early 50s, you know what? They're just tired. And basically he wrote me a prescription for antidepressants and I put it in my pocket and I never took it in. And I'm not belittling depression because it's a real thing. And I know people that have had it, close people that have had it. So I'm not belittling that, but I didn't think that's not what this is. I was happy that I'm not in one day. No, I don't think it works that way. So I didn't take it, and then it just kept perpetuating and not going away. Fran told me you should probably work out. I tried working out, and that's where I had that point on my workout bench. I just broke down and started crying, and I just said, God, why is this happening? I mean, everything that I've asked, you've given me more than what I've asked for. It seems like I've got everything I need. Now I just feel like dying. You know, I couldn't wrap my arms around it. A couple days after that, I went into the office. And before I start work, I just checked the news on the internet and I saw this little trailer about the Left Behind series of books, Tim LaHaye, the other guy that wrote them. And it's basically what would happen if the rapture were to happen, in our lifetime, what would that look like? And I thought, well, I would not be left behind, would I? I mean, I go to church. And that's the thing. I mean, I've been going to church for years, but it wasn't really engaged in my life. But I go to church. We give it to a multitude of nonprofits. I mean, I would not be left behind, would I? You know, there was that question again, that validation. So I ordered the first book, and I'm going to tell you right now, I loved it. And and the reason I loved it was because I started reading the Bible in the morning. I should mention that. And then that's what got me hooked on the Left Behind series as well, because as I was reading that, I'm going like, I was reading the Left Behind series and they kept mentioning the Bible. And then I just went, maybe I'm going to look up the Bible and see if this is BS or if this is real. And, you know, sure enough, it was in there. It wasn't word for word, but it was pretty close. And I went, maybe I should be reading the Bible. So I started in John. So if you start in the beginning, it might blow your hair back. But I started in John in the New Testament and kind of went that way through it. And then I'd come in and pray in the office for about 10 minutes. And then I'd read for about 20 minutes in the morning. And then at night, I'd read that Left Behind series of books. I think there's like 12 of them. And that cadence of that was very helpful. At night, when I'd read that Left Behind series, I would get so involved in the book, I would get my mind off my despair. So imagine if you had a migraine headache and you could read something that would take that headache away for an hour. Wouldn't you do it? And so that's what I started doing. And it took about a year before that completely started to clear itself. But it made me realize that what I was missing was God. It wasn't the money. The money was not the thing. I could see right away, and I wasn't so stupid that I couldn't see it, but you know, good and evil are real in our world. If you don't believe it, you might want to look into that. There's an undercurrent of good and evil that's always working you. When I had that amount of money back then, I thought I made it. It was like, there's a little devil on my shoulder going, dude, if you look out farther, if you make a little bit more, you'll get through this. And was smart enough to realize that I'm not falling for that because it's just a mirage, man. I mean, he points out to you see a little oasis in the desert. By the time you get there, it moves again. And so I knew that money could never get there. It had to be something else. And, you know, really, sinking my mind, into the Bible, and then really listening at mass instead of just showing up, but listening. And then I started reading some devotionals, daily devotionals, not just Catholic ones, Charles Stanley, Max Lucado. I still to this day read those, Bishop Barron, the Catholic readings. I can't make mass during the week. I read those on my computer. And you had to get a fresh outlook on life and looking at things differently. I changed my life. And then when I took over as president and CEO, our business was in a really bad place. Back in 2007, 2008, a really bad recession, the worst one since the Great Depression. And it was the mortgage debacle that started that whole thing. And so 2 minute truck is kind of close to that. You know, if you can't buy houses, you can't move. But I asked God, I want you're starting to straighten out my life. Is there any way you can help me straighten out your business? And when I started praying over the business, and I'm talking about any big meeting I went into, I prayed before it. Anytime that I was, somebody was coming in for a job interview, I prayed over that. I started praying over everything. And I can't, and it's written in my, it goes into great detail in the book. Books are really easy to read, but it talks about all those different things I did and the kind of challenges that Two Men and a Truck came out, and we excelled during the recession. We were just doing more of the less moving going on out there. And I don't want your listeners to think, I started drinking the Kool-Aid so God took care of me. No. I mean, there were some tough decisions I had to make that God put on my heart. And I would follow through with those. And it really started to work out. So it was first bringing God into my life and changing this wretched sinner. You read the book, I go into detail about that. And then giving the business to him and watching the amount of things that happened in that business were absolutely amazing. And, we built that business. It was big. I mean, we were doing over $650. I mean, we're doing at some points 2 to 3 moves every minute of every hour of every day, 24/7.
It was cracking me up the other day when we were talking. I was in the car driving. I was like, oh, there's a Two Men in a Truck just right next to me. It's like, oh, yeah, shocker, you know. And then the next day, one pulled up right next to me too. And like, oh, yeah, it's $650,000. Yeah, that makes about that sounds about right.
It's funny. Now you bump into Mark 6 where it talks about the five loaves and the two fish feeding the 5,000.
Uh-huh.
And people thinking that's a fable. It's like, this is what it looks like now, people. When God can take two ragtag brothers and build a business like this, I think is more of a miracle than the loaves and the fish, to be quite honest with you.
Did you incorporate like an internal level, or were you doing that with other team members?
It was everybody. We started having Bible studies at work, and a good friend of mine is a Southern Baptist preacher, and I'd have him come in at our annual meetings. We would have a prayer breakfast that my family would pay for. And, by the end, we had over 300 people that bear breakfast was costing us $20,000 to $30,000, you know. Mm-hmm. It's because, you know, you're having it in a hotel feeding 300 people. We would bring some speakers in. And so it was one of those things where as a CEO, I had an open door policy. My door was open 99% of the time. I tell people if the door is open, come in. If it's shut, don't come to it. But you don't have to email me, text me, just show up. And I'd get people to just show up with a dumb joke, or I'd get somebody that would come in and be having an issue with their child or with their marriage, because they knew that over time I could be trusted. All right, just because you slap a fish on the back of your bumper doesn't make you a Christian. People have to see it in your life. They have to see it in the decisions that you make. And as a CEO, there's many difficult decisions that you have to make, but you better be able to, even the tough ones that aren't popular, you better tell them why. This is why. And they want to see what people want to see what's this based on? Is this based on you making more money? Is this based on what? They found out they're biblically based principles. And, so people could trust you more to come in and talk to you. And having that trust allows you to steer that ship of your business. You know, that trust is like a rudder that goes a little bit deeper in the water, that you are able, you know, to cut against the wind in some situations, and people are going to follow you because they know what your decisions are based on. It's not just about money.
Wow. Well, that's powerful stuff. And then, as it grew, I mean, you had already kind of won the ball game on the internal level because you had found your relationship with God. And,
it would dumbfound people because, I wore my faith on my sleeve because I believed in it. And, the amount of people that would just sit there and even if people are believers, it's just, they can't argue with success. You know, the business is on fire. I mean, we didn't have any debt. We had everything paid off. We poured a lot of money back into training and things like that, and keeping our franchises strong, and our franchisees believed in what we were doing. And so that's a really good way to give your testimony, is by how you act at work instead of on Sunday, right? My wife and I crack up because on Sunday when everybody's leaving the church, everyone's taking turns pulling out of the parking lot. You go. No, you go. No, you go. By Tuesday, people are flipping each other off, cutting each other off. It's like, can you just be as good on Thursday as you are on Sunday pulling out of church? And so when people start seeing that, you know, seeing why, how you're running the business, and I put it out there. People knew it. People knew even in the community where I was. And I really felt the Holy Spirit guided me. And I was not afraid ever to stand up and say what my beliefs are and live them in all aspects of your life. Because if your faith is strong, it's strong in every portion of your life as a parent, as a friend, mm-hmm. As a son or a daughter, a neighbor. At work, at play, all those things. Now, I'm not saying that we're not going to trip and fall sometimes, right? Sometimes you wake up in the morning and went, I can't believe I said that. I can't believe we do that. We're human. We're broken. So also cut yourself some slack, man. I mean, we're not perfect.
So, you know, it's the timing of you sharing this is uncanny in that we were just at a business conference called the Lion's Den basically an organization filled with Christians that, believe in running your business as a mission, right? And incorporating it throughout. And, on our internal team, we very much have believers in the leadership, but we haven't done a prayer group. We haven't been as intentional about, the Christian principles throughout the organization, even though we are running it as a business or as a mission. And, so it's inspiring because, you know, we're, you know, we got home from the event just excited about it, like, oh, we're gonna do all these things, and then Monday rolls around and like fear and anxiety hits where it's like, we're gonna do this, you know, like you know, you mentioned the spiritual warfare earlier, but like, you know, having that negative voice in your head and
well, you know, one of the examples, Jim, is like I remember going through the recession. I don't know. I think we did 10% less business than we did the year before, right in the meat of it. But as a moving company, I was so happy. And our franchisees, I mean, our corporate office employees, we would always give, bonuses at the end of the year. Nobody expected bonuses. And so my family decided we're going to give bonuses anyway, because man, we did our best and our employees did their best. And, I remember, our controller putting the checks on my desk, and I remember crying over those things. And I'm not a crier, but just the amount of gratitude that I had for that. And, I mean, I remember the tears landing on the pile of checks, because we got down to a point where we only had, and it's all in the book, we had $500,000 in cash. That was it. When I took over, it was just in a really, really awkward spot. And I knew that we were climbing up, we were on our way back. But after passing those checks out we had a Christmas lunch, and I prayed, because we had, you know, at that time, I think we had 78, 79 employees at our corporate office. When we sold 3 years ago, we had over 200. But back then, I just remember saying, I know all of you aren't Christian, but I'm going to tell you what, God walks these halls and he shines on everybody. So if you enjoy working here, I'm glad. But we're going to pray and thank God for this. And if you're not a Christian, understand something, that rays of hope are on you, even though that you're not. But that's where it's coming from. And people would walk in the office, they could feel the culture. They could just feel the energy in there. And I went, that's because Jesus is here. He's walking the halls. And we did. We brought a number of people to Christ in the office. On the other side too, we had a Bible study that we had very diehard Christians that didn't go to the Bible study. I didn't pay attention to that. I know they're Christians. I know that it's like, I can't bring them, busy. It's like, I get that. It's cool. You don't have to. And sometimes they would stop in. Sometimes they wouldn't. We would bring lunch in free. So people just come and listen. You know, there's no test. There's no quiz. But it's just bringing that faith in, Ten Commandments on a poster in our lobby for years. And we built onto our business, and I had an employee come up to me and say, are you going to put the Ten Commandments back up? And I said, no. And he goes, oh man, that's too bad. I said, no, because it's going on the outside of the building in stone. So we had the Ten Commandments on our building in stone with the light on them. And out my window, I could see them. And I would see people that would walk by and they would stop and take pictures of it. I had people that would, especially when it came to IT, they were so hard to find back in the day, that some of these IT people that would come in for an interview, they're being interviewed by four or five different companies. And I had a few of them just say, when I saw that Ten Commandments there, I knew that that's where I wanted to work. And so I know that we were able to get some employees because of that. Now on the other side, damn good ones that left. I don't know. You just live it and take your time with it. And I would, my suggestion would be for some of your listeners that want to bring in faith into their business, man, leave the posters and all that stuff at home. Get yourself into a very good place. Start reading the Bible, start even, devotionals, start working on yourself first. And as a leader, let that radiate from you. As you are getting closer to Christ, you are going to radiate that out also to your family, right? And your neighbors and your friends. And it all of a sudden it radiates in your business without you bring in the group. You know what I mean? This is what we're going to do here. Don't do that. That's so fake and it's not real. I will tell you this. If you get into your faith and you start living it, and start making decisions based on your faith, you're going to lose some friends. You're also going to gain some. I'm a 61-year-old dude now. My top five friends, they continuously change, and so do I. But my people that I'm close to, they live for God. They live for their wives or their husbands or their families, and they work hard. And those, my top five friends in my life have those things in common. And I can't say that maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago. They change. Everything changes. Take a look at who you hang out with. I do. I'm not preaching to anybody. I did this. What do they bring into your life? There's some people you have to look at and go, I got to kick that dude to the curb, you know, not because he's down on his luck, but because he doesn't bring, you know, he sucks my will to live when he walks into a room. You know what I mean? He's negative. The things that are important to him aren't important to me anymore. So, you know, and you have some really good friends all of a sudden show up in your life that it's like, man, I'm going to be more like him, or I want to be more like her. I like the attributes that person has. That makes, and God puts those people in our lives, but we really have to regulate and watch the people that we hang out with, what we listen to and what we watch. I mean, it's just something you say to your kids, but it's true for us adult men too.
So, I mean, you've had, wow, you've had a journey, man. Well, thanks for your time. I'm so appreciative of it. I mean, is there any like final thoughts?
Yeah, I would say that, especially for, you know, the leaders in your, that are listening, your window of opportunity is not open forever. And so take advantage of the place that you are right now. Be the best version of yourself and see what it does, because not only will it increase, the bounty of your business, but also with your family. And so when you go into work, look for ways of being the best version of yourself. And through God is the best way that I've found. Being a hard ass in the business world, you know, it's macho, but it's not sustainable. Be the best version of yourself, in the office. Find out who those people that are engaged that you can trust in the business. Get them into the excitement and the adventure of the business. And yeah, you'll have a couple losses there, but more wins than losses. And it's also, it's a lot funner to win as a pack than it is by yourself. If that makes any sense, Jim.
Absolutely. It does. Well, thanks again for coming in, and guys, thanks for tuning in. This is a wrap for another Passive Wealth Show episode, and we will see you next time.
All right. Thank you, Jim.